policeman who died.
History is a perverse mechanism, said Holmes between puffs. It demands the blood of martyrs, real or invented, the way a machine requires oil.
Inspector Bonfield grunted, checked the brief gap in the traffic, and stepped out onto the street, motioning for Holmes to follow.
This has been paved over by Hot Top since the riot and trial, said Bonfield. But you'll remember that it was about here.
The inspector's polished shoe came down on an unremarkable spot.
That you showed me the egg-shaped indentation in the cedar block paving of that time, where the heavy bomb had first struck, and
Bonfield stepped further out into the street.
It was here where you noticed the smooth, oval crater where the bomb had actually exploded. By lining up the small impact dent with the actual crater, using red string in the model you provided us, we were able to show that the bomb had been thrown from the alley, not from somewhere south of the advancing police, as the defense would have had the jury to believe.
Inspector Bonfield was so immersed in the memory that he failed to notice a large dray wagon with four huge horses bearing down on him. Holmes gathered the police detective by the elbow and moved him safely to the curb opposite the alley.
The bomb went off right beneath Patrolman Matthias Deegan, continued Bonfield, speaking as if from a mesmeric trance. Deegan was a friend of mine. The shrapnel that killed him was no bigger than your thumbnail, Mr. Holmes. The doctor gave it to me, and I have it in my bureau. But it severed Matthias's femoral artery, and he bled to death, right there on where the cedar paving blocks used to be, and in my arms.
We proved that six of the eight policemen who had been shot, rather than those wounded by bomb shrapnel, had been shot at a downward angle, said Holmes. Someone firing a rifle from that window up there next to the alley.
He pointed at the window of the corner shop facing Desplaines Street.
The prosecution made that case, but the jury made nothing of it, said Inspector Bonfield. But your evidence, Mr. Holmes, did prove that the carpenter Rudolf Schnaubelt was the man who threw the bomb from that alley right at the cluster of police.
Showed it beyond a doubt, agreed Holmes. But you've never apprehended or arrested him.
Inspector Bonfield held his hands out.
How can we arrest him if we can't find him, Mr. Holmes? We've tracked down leads saying Schnaubelt was in Pittsburgh, in Santo Domingo, that he died in California, that he was begging in the streets of Honduras, and that he was living in wealth in Mexico. That socialist rag, the Arbeiter Zeitung, published a letter, reportedly from Schnaubelt, and the letter had been postmarked from Christiania, Norway. The man is a phantom, Mr. Holmes.
The man, Schnaubelt, has been making a good living as a manufacturer of farm machinery in Buenos Aires, said Holmes. He arrived in Argentina a month after the Haymarket Square riot and has lived and prospered there ever since.
Why didn't you tell us this?
I cabled all the information, including Schnaubelt's work and living address, to your major and superintendent of police in early 1887, said Holmes. There was no reply. I sent a second cable with the same information, this time including various aliases Schnaubelt had used. Again, I received no response.
Bonfeld had taken off his cap and looked as if he was preparing to rip clumps of his hair out by the roots. Holmes glanced at his watch and removed his pipe.
It's getting late, Inspector. You're my liaison while we follow the carriage route that will carry President Cleveland to the exposition grounds. And then I'm scheduled to receive a quick tour of the White City itself, but we'll have to trot to get to the Lexington Hotel by their departure time.
We'll let the horse do the trotting, said Inspector Bonfield.
He whistled, and a sleek black carriage, driven by a uniformed Chicago PD patrolman, glided up. The driver jumped down and opened the carriage door for them. There were two carriages waiting for Bonfield and Holmes outside the Lexington Hotel at the intersection of 22nd Street and Michigan Avenue. The first was an oversized canopy-covered surrey with three bench rows of seats facing forward rather than the usual two, plus a fourth bench seat looking backward. It was filled with uniformed police officers. The second was an open carriage, much more comfortable looking, and the driver was a big man with bright blue eyes and a trim salt-and-pepper beard that looked a bit like that of former President Ulysses S. Grant. Holmes estimated from the man's hands that he might be around 60, but there were no wrinkles, save for a few laugh lines, on his face. He wore a working man's comfortable corduroy trousers and well-worn boots, but also a rather expensive-looking wool hacking jacket. Most noticeable was the black slouch hat set back on his head, as if he wanted the April sun to turn his winter-pale forehead pink. Inspector Bonfield said, "Mr. Sherlock Holmes, may I have the honor of introducing you to our mayor-elect, Mr. Carter Henry Harrison?" The handshake was firm without being bruising.
"I'm delighted, absolutely delighted to meet you, Mr. Holmes," said Harrison.
"Mayor-elect?" asked Holmes.
"I was elected for a fifth term, not sequential, I'm ashamed to say, on April 4th, said Harrison. "But I don't officially take office until the 20th. But Mayor Washburn was busy sulking and cleaning out his office, so I jumped at the chance to show you the route we'll be taking with President Cleveland."
One of the police officers was walking back to the mayor's carriage, and the mayor said in a very soft voice to Bonfield,
"Uh-oh, here comes McClory."
Holmes could see by the badges, McClory was the superintendent of the Chicago police force. Mayor Harrison introduced him as such, and again there was a handshake, this one even more enthusiastic.
"Mr. Holmes, I have been looking forward to meeting you," said Chief McClory. "When I was a warden of the Illinois State Prison at Joliet, I was responsible for creating America's first full system of bertillonage. You use that system, I believe."
"To be honest, I know and respect Monsieur Bertillon, and have worked with him in Paris, but I found that many of his categories of identifying criminals, bone length, centimeters of forehead, and all that, are rather unworkable. So these days I concentrate almost exclusively on fingerprints."
"Ah,"
said Superintendent McClory, seeming a bit cast down by Holmes's lack of enthusiasm toward the full category of bertillonage.
"Yes, well, we have fingerprint cards as well. More than 500 at present. Do you keep your own card, sir, or depend upon Scotland Yard's?"
"I'm sorry to say that Scotland Yard has not yet adopted fingerprinting as a universal practice," said Holmes. "But I have an assistant who visits the prisons, and we make our own cards. Photograph of the suspect on front, prints of all fingers and the palm on back. I believe I have about 3,000 such cards on file."
Superintendent McClory was visibly startled at this information.
"Bab," said Mayor-elect Harrison, "it's time to move out. You're welcome to ride with us, and Bonfield can ride with the patrolman."
"No, I shall ride with my men," McClory said stiffly. "It was a great, great pleasure, Mr. Holmes, and I do hope we meet again when we have time to discuss Bertillon's methods and other forensic matters."
A final handshake, and the chief of police marched back to his crowded Surrey.
"Hop on up here next to me, Mr. Holmes," said Harrison. "Bonnie, you get in back with Mr. Drummond. I believe you know Drummond, do you not, Mr. Holmes?"
Holmes nodded at the Secret Service director.
"Yes, a pleasure to see you here, sir."
Drummond smiled and returned the nod.
"All right, it's time,"
said the mayor-elect, and touched the two horses gently with his whip.
"I presume that President Cleveland will be staying there at the Lexington Hotel," said Holmes.
"Yep,"
said Harrison. "It's got the largest suite in town, but if it had been me choosing a hotel for the president, I would have picked one on a paved street."
Holmes had noticed that this stretch of Michigan Avenue was more yellow dirt than pavement.
"Just so it doesn't rain on opening day, we'll be okay," said Harrison. "This was the furthest south high-quality hotel, built just last year, so I suppose it makes sense. It shouldn't take more than about 20-25 minutes to get to the fair going down Michigan Avenue."
"Too bad Superintendent McClory didn't choose to ride with us," said Drummond from his place behind the mayor. "We need to discuss CPD security arrangements, as well as the Columbian Guard security."
Harrison chuckled and adjusted the brim of his black slouch hat to keep the sun out of his eyes.
Chief McClary is a good man and a dedicated reformer. He sent me his letter of resignation on the day I was elected.
Why? Said Holmes.
Harrison grinned.
All of the things Bob wants to reform, gambling, kickbacks to party officials, drinking, dallying with the ladies of the night, are more or less the things I most enjoy doing.
Mayor Harrison has very strong support amongst the working class, said Inspector Bonfield from behind Sherlock, even among the colored folk. Holmes decided that this was all the local politics he needed to hear. More than enough, actually. He said,
How many officers in Chicago's police force, Mayor?
A little over 3,000, said Harrison. We'll have mounted officers riding along and ahead when the actual procession from the Lexington gets going, but my guess is that a couple hundred thousand folks will be walking and riding behind us, joining the parade, so to speak.
And there are 2,000 some Colombian guards inside the fair, said Sherlock.
That number of uniformed officers, said Bonfield, plus about 200 plainclothes detectives under my supervision on the fairgrounds, both in the White City and along the Midway Pleasance, where we expect the pickpockets and others to do most of their work.
Hand-picked detectives?
Asked Holmes.
Hand-picked not just from the CPD, but from all over the United States, said Inspector Bonfield.
Mr. Drummond, what about your agents? Said Holmes.
Mayor Harrison broke in.
When Mr. Drummond showed up this morning and told me that he was from the Treasury Department, I was sure the jig was up. All my back taxes catching up to me.
Someday, Mr. Mayor, Drummond said softly.
Someday.
To Holmes, he said, I'll have 55 Secret Service agents in place when President Cleveland gets to the exposition grounds. 8 of them are master marksmen, and they've been checked out with the newest Army sniper rifles. 6 are on permanent detail with the president.
Tall men, I hope, said Holmes.
None under 6'3", said Drummond. But of course, no one can be standing in front of the president when he gives his opening address.
How many carriages will be in this procession? Asked Holmes.
Harrison grinned again.
My guess is somewhere between 20 and 25 coaches. Mr. Cleveland and his immediate entourage will be in a Landau. Very important Chicagoans keep coming out of the woodwork like cockroaches, and they all want to be in President Cleveland's procession to the fair. All I know for sure is that I'll be in the last carriage, whatever number that will be.
Why is that? Asked Holmes.
Because I'm going to get the most applause and happy shouts from the crowd of anyone in the procession, said Harrison,
who was obviously just stating a fact rather than bragging.
I wouldn't want President Cleveland to hear that if I were ahead of him. It might hurt his feelings.
Does the Landau have a top? Asked Drummond.
A foldable top, said Inspector Bonfield. It'll be folded back so that everyone, even those in the higher buildings, can see the president. Unless it's raining, of course.
Pray for rain, Drummond said softly, speaking to himself.
Oh, Mr. Mayor, said Bonfield, Mr. Holmes informed me that he knows the whereabouts of Rudolf Schnaubelt, the Haymarket Square bomb thrower.
You don't have to tell me who Rudolf Schnaubelt is, goddammit, snarled Harrison. I've had enough nightmares about the son of a bitch. Where do you think he is, Mr. Holmes?
I know exactly where he is, said Holmes, and gave the mayor Schnaubelt's farm business and personal addresses in Buenos Aires.
Well, I'll be dipped in shit, said Harrison. Bonnie, can't you send some of your boys down there to Buenos Aires to get that murdering reptile?
We have no extradition arrangements with Argentina, Mr. Mayor.
God damn it, I know that, said Harrison. I mean, get him. A black bag job. Haul that goddamn anarchist back here to Chicago for a fair trial and very public hanging.
If the Argentinian authorities were to discover a plot like that, it would mean war, Bonfield said softly.
It'll be a sad day when the United States of America can't whip some pissant country like Argentina, said Harrison. Okay, Bonnie, maybe we could just send someone down to shoot the son of a bitch. Bang! Take a picture of the corpse for the Chicago papers. No muss, No fuss.
We should talk about this later, said Bonfield.
You're right, laughed Harrison. I have my favorite literary hero of all time right here in my carriage to ask questions of. Tell me, Mr. Holmes, in The Sign of the Four, you were injecting a 7% solution of cocaine into your arm or wrist when you were barred. Was that accurate?
A habit I abandoned after my friend Dr. Watson convinced me that, how did the good doctor put it, that the game was not worth the candle.
Holmes saw no reason to mention his morning injection of this more powerful heroic drug, or the fact that he planned to inject it twice more before this day was over.
Ah, good, cried Harrison. So tell me, if you are free to do so, in that same adventure, do you think the lovely Miss Mary Morstan had romantic designs on you? Did she just settle, as we say, by marrying Dr. Watson?
Holmes looked up at the clear sky and sighed. This was going to be a long carriage ride. 6. Wednesday, April 12, 3:20 p.m.
Can I get you something to help you feel better?
Asked James.
A 40 caliber six-shooter so that I can blow my brains out, said Sam Clemens. Or, since I am a devout coward, perhaps some painless poison that tastes like lemonade.
Anything other than that?
Asked James. He was sitting on a chair by the window a few feet from where Clemens, in his nightshirt, lay in bed. There were medicines and half-filled glasses on the bedside table, and a pile of newspapers tossed on the only other chair.
One doctor says this is just a bad case of the common grip, and he's predicted every day in the last 11 days that I'd be up and out of this bed on the next day,
said Clemens between coughs.
The other doctor who's looked in on me says that it's pneumonia, and that at my advanced age, 58, I should get my will in order and start getting measured for my coffin. I have the strongest urge to put these two medicos in a pit and see which one comes out alive.
James smiled at that.
What brought you and Mr. Sherlock Holmes to the Great Northern Hotel, anyway?
Asked Clemens, setting down his awful-smelling cigar long enough to drink from a tall glass of colored fluid, grimace at its taste, and pick up the smoking cigar again.
Holmes chose it, said James.
Clemens had one of the corner rooms which included three tall windows in the curving bay, and James had all three open to the relatively fresh air of downtown Chicago. This hotel was at the corner of Jackson and Dearborn, and this was about all that James knew of Chicago geography.
He overheard a clerk telling a bellboy to take up a fresh pitcher of water with lemons to your room, added James. That's how I knew you were here. I was surprised. When I was told you were ill, I thought I should check in on you.
That's right, neighborly, said Clemens, and stopped to cough.
It was a deep, phlegmy cough, and James leaned back a little more into the fresh air.
I plan to leave for New York tomorrow, Mr. James, if I have to do so in a coffin, with a chunk of aged Limburger cheese on my chest for verisimilitude. I may have to ask you to be my pallbearer.
Clemens coughed and drank from the glass again. He poured more colored liquid from a quart-sized bottle into the glass.
Is that cough syrup of some sort?
Asked James.
Of some sort, said Clemens, and took another long drink. It's laudanum, liquid opium, a gift from the gods. My second doctor isn't shy about prescribing it by the hogshead barrel. So far, it's the only thing that's smoothed this cough.
Wonderful, thought James. Holmes is injecting himself with that new heroin drug every day, and Clemens, Mark Twain, is busy turning himself into a laudanum addict. Did you get your business done here in Chicago? Asked James. You told us in Hartford that you had people to see.
Clemens snorted.
I made the rounds of interested investors in Page's typesetting machine, but they are small-minded, James. Small-minded. They insist on seeing a working example of the typesetter. They are prejudiced in favor of earning their money back with interest.
And Page doesn't have a working model?
He tells me almost every other week that he has a perfect working model, said Clemens. But when I rush to see it and get within 50 miles of him, the machine either quits working or Page decides to dismantle it and improve it in some arcane mechanical way. He's in Chicago to set up a second factory to produce the things, while the first factory has yet to spit out a model that works for more than 2 minutes at a time.
Did you see Mr. Page while you were here?
Clemens drank deeply from his glass of laudanum and refilled the glass from the bottle.
He's been wonderfully attentive, visited my sick room at least 6 times, staying hours each time.
And? Said James after a silence that had Clemens staring at nothing.
And do you remember,
said Clemens, glaring at James from under his bushy white eyebrows,
how I said that Page could convince a fish to come out of the water and take a walk with him?
Yes.
Well, this time he convinced this particular fish to come out, take a walk with him, climb a tree, and make noises like a parakeet.
James didn't know what to say to that, so he remained silent, trying to breathe the fresh air from the open windows rather than the odious air from Clemens's cheap cigar.
I came to demand, not request, not ask nicely for, but to demand, continued Clemens, that Page immediately refund me the last $30,000 I'd put into this project. I need it. I'd borrowed from my little publishing venture to pay for the investment in the typesetter, and now circumstances demand that I borrow from the typesetter investment to keep my publishing house afloat. So I came to demand, in no uncertain terms, $30,000 of the $190,000 that I'd poured into Page's bottomless pit.
And did he pay up? Asked Henry James.
It ended with me writing him a check for $50,000 more,
grumbled Clemens,
so that he can make those last few little improvements before the automatic typesetting machine sets the publishing world on its ear. And I become a millionaire!
Clemens coughed fiercely, and when he'd caught his breath and drunk some laudanum, said,
I fin myself far up and out of the creek this time. Livy will kill me.
I hope it works out,
said James, who had never invested in anything save for his own talent.
Say, where's your friend Sherlock Holmes these days?
Asked Clemens.
Today he went to meet various people at the White City, said James.
Have you seen the exposition yet, James?
Not yet.
The White City is yet another thing in this life that I shall never see,
sighed Clemens. Then, without any preamble, Clemens said,
Does Holmes still believe that he might be a fictional person rather than real?
Taken back a bit, James finally said,
I believe he does.
He may be right,
said Clemens.
Why do you say that, sir?
I've read the stories in The Strand and the novellas, and the Sherlock Holmes there strikes me as a particularly unrealistic fellow. His adventures sound contrived.
You may remember Holmes saying in New York that he wasn't totally happy with Dr. Watson's representations of either him or his science of deduction, said James. The tales may be true, but written by a mediocre mind.
In the past weeks, I've been thinking,
said Clemens.
I doubt that there is any Dr. Watson. It's all that Conan Doyle fellow creating a fictional narrator to relate the fictional tales of a fictional detective.
Holmes says that Conan Doyle is his friend Watson's agent and editor, said James. He says that Dr. John Watson shuns the spotlight and that he allows Doyle to represent him.
But what if Holmes is a fictional character and this whole assassination plot is part of some melodramatic tale or make-believe,
said Clemens, coughing more and drinking more of the laudanum mixture.
Where does that leave you and me, Mr. Henry James?
How do you mean? Said James, knowing full well what Clemens was leading up to.
It would mean that we are fictional characters in this instance as well,
said Clemens, staring balefully out from under his shaggy eyebrows.
You chosen as his Sancho Panza, or perhaps as his Boswell, and me as occasional comedy relief.
I'll never be his Boswell, James said flatly.
Have you ever thought, James, of the relationship between you and the characters you've created?
I'm not sure what you mean, James said, knowing full well what the humorist meant.
I mean that you're God to them, said Clemens, just as I am God to my small worlds of fictional people. You create them. You put them through their fictional paces. You decide their emotions, and you decide when it's time for them to die. In other words, we're God to our characters.
James shook his head. My characters have a certain life of their own, he said softly.
Oh,
said Clemens, and surrendered to a spasm of phlegmy coughing.
Does that mean that Isabella Archer is having tea in England or Europe right now?
No, said James, but it means there are depths to her, to Isabel's character, that I haven't explored.
This is writer's double talk, said Clemens, drinking deeply from his glass. We love to pretend that our characters have some lives of their own, but they don't, James. You know it, and I know it. We move them around like puppets in a Punch and Judy show. Have you read any of my books, sir?
I've not yet had that pleasure, said James, surprised by the question. Writers didn't ask other writers for opinions of their work. It just wasn't done. Clemens laughed.
Well, I've tried to read yours, said the white-haired author. I declare, James, reading your prose is like translating medieval German. You have 42 freight cars loaded with subordinate clauses being pushed along by a tiny cluster of underpowered engine verbs tucked in at the end of the sentence. Reading your books is like listening to a man on a soapbox argue with himself, interrupting himself every few seconds.
James smiled thinly. My brother William would agree with you.
But still, with Isabella Archer and a few of your other characters.
Clemens's voice trailed off. He turned to stare fiercely at James again.
Do you know why Isabella Archer made that damned fool self-destructive decision at the end of the book? Was that your plan all along? Or did the character take on some autonomy and make her life-ruining decision on her own?
James lifted his hands, palms up. He was not going to discuss Isabella Archer or any of his other books or characters with this laudanum-addled American.
You hear your characters' voices in your head or you don't,
said Clemens, speaking to himself.
Do you happen to remember that I published a book called The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn about 5 years ago?
I remember, said James. Clemens looked at him again.
For months, years really, since I'd set the book aside for a long time, I heard Huck's voice in my head as clearly as I heard my beloved Livy calling me to dinner. Huck was with me when I went to sleep at night, and he was waiting for me when I woke up. And then, near what should have been the end of the story, when they're off the raft for the last time and Huck's slave friend Jim has been captured, Huck just left me. He just lit out for the territory without me. I could no longer hear his voice, no longer look through his eyes. I was just a man putting words on paper.
What did you do? Asked James, more interested in this topic and in the answer than he could show. Clemens licked his lips.
I brought in Tom Sawyer from his book, turned Huck into the shallow supporting character he'd been in that Tom Sawyer book, and essentially let the most important book I've ever written turn into another boy's book, said Clemens. All games and coincidences, and no harm done to anyone with Tom, a character whom I knew shouldn't even be in this novel, making the decisions.
That sort of situation is unfortunate, James said softly, and I am sure that it happens to all of us in writing one novel or the other. Clemens shook his head.
Have you read the novel Robert Elsmere?
I've heard the title, but haven't had the pleasure of reading it, said James.
It created quite a sensation about 5 years ago and caused the rumpus, said Clemens. It was written by Mrs. Humphrey Ward. It advocated a Christianity based on social concerns and help for one's fellow man rather than on scripture or theology. She made a lot of devout enemies.
James waited.
Anyway,
continued Clemens after some coughing and expectorating,
I copied a sentence from that long, sometimes dismal book because it relates to what we're discussing. Mrs. Ward wrote, and I remember it clearly, I cannot conceive of God as the arch plotter against his own creation.
That doesn't sound very radical, said James. Clemens rounded on him again.
But we're God to the world and characters we create, James, and we plot against them all the time. We kill them off, maul and scar them, make them lose their hopes and dearest loves. We conspire against our characters daily. But in the Huck Finn book, I lost my nerve, James. I lost Huck's voice, and then I lost my nerve. Or maybe, probably, it was the other way around. I so loved Huckleberry Finn that I failed to plot against him and the rest of my creation as I should have. If Huck's voice had stayed with me, if I'd had the courage to listen to it, I would have had Nigger Jim captured and sold down the river to endless slavery in front of Huck's eyes and in spite of all of Huck's efforts. Or, at the very least, had the decency and mercy to kill Jim and Huck, rather than bring Tom Sawyer into the tale to end it as a mere boy's book.
Clemens spat out the last two words. What has this to do with the question of whether Sherlock Holmes is fictional? James asked bluntly. He hated writers' self-pity and detested watching it. Clemens laughed until he began coughing again.
Don't you see, James?
He said at last.
You and I are only minor characters in this story about the great detective. Our little lives and endings mean nothing to the God writer, whoever the son of a bitch might be.
Do you have any idea who that God writer might be? Asked James. I've thought about this. Conan Doyle would never use living contemporaries in his tales, certainly not use their real names or make them so recognizable. Holmes said that Watson had to disguise the Prince of Wales as the King of Bohemia in one story.
It doesn't have to be Conan Doyle, said Clemens,
his chin almost on his chest as he poured the last of the laudanum from the bottle into the glass.
It's almost certainly some lesser mind. Lesser talent than you, perhaps even lesser than me, Certainly lesser than Arthur Conan Doyle, which is saying a lot. And it might be written 30 years hence, or 50, or 100.
Well, said James, trying for a light tone despite the heaviness in his heart, at least that would mean we're still being read 30 or 100 years from now. There was a long silence, broken only by street sounds some 14 floors below, and the raspy, phlegm-filled effort of Samuel Clemens to breathe. If we are only fictional constructs, brought in to give the fictional construct Sherlock Holmes company, what do we do next? James finally asked. Clemens laughed.
I'm going east to New York tomorrow, stopping at Elmira if I feel up to it. I'll probably be too sick to watch the procession of great ships scheduled for this weekend in New York Harbor, but I'd give 2 toes to see that. No, sir, if the god writer of this tale, hack that he probably is, wants to kill this Sam Clemens off, he will have to do it off stage, the way Shakespeare killed Falstaff.
I need to leave, too, thought James. Regain my autonomy. Regain myself.
What are you doing tomorrow?
Asked Clemens.
Holmes said that he wanted to take me on a boat tour of the White City.
Well, enjoy what I'll never see, said Clemens.
I'll look in on you tomorrow after my boat tour, said James. See if there's anything you need.
You could tell the porter, the little one with the hare lip, to tell the house doctor that I need a new jug of laudanum, said Clemens. And a straw.
James nodded.
As far as looking in on me tomorrow, said Sam Clemens, there's no reason to. One way or the other, I'll be written out of this story by then.
7. Friday, April 14, 10:06 a.m. Even though Friday morning was gray, chilly, and threatening rain, Holmes had hired an open landau for their carriage ride to the exposition. James brought along his umbrella. Holmes was wearing the bright red scarf that he favored whenever the temperature dropped below 70 degrees. The driver was bundled in wool up on his perch. Holmes was as taciturn this day as he had been voluble on their boat tour the day before. When James questioned him as to whether he'd driven to the fair this way before, Holmes said that the mayor of Chicago had driven him this way on Wednesday.
What is Mayor Harrison like? Asked James.
Talkative, said Holmes.
But then, after a moment of silence broken only by the sound of horses' hooves and passing carriages, he added,
and strangely likable, almost certainly corrupt, but loved by his constituencies, I think.
What is the object of our outing today? Asked James.
We're deciding where Lucan Adler will lurk to carry out his assassination,
Holmes said so softly it was almost a whisper.
I know nothing about the mental processes of assassins,
hissed James.
All right, Holmes said in a regular voice, but I thought you might like to see the exposition grounds before you leave Chicago tomorrow.
We're leaving Chicago tomorrow?
You are, said Holmes, and threw his red scarf over his shoulder.
The ride to the south side of the city seemed interminable, although James realized it took less than half an hour.
This will be President Cleveland's route to the fair, whispered James.
Holmes nodded. James looked at all the buildings, rooftops, alleys.
It would seem that an assassin could secret himself anywhere along here.
The Chicago police force will have more than 1,000 men lining the route so that no one can rush the carriage, Holmes said, sotto voce. Hundreds more behind the procession, since Mayor Harrison predicts up to 200,000 people following the carriages for at least part of the way.
Holmes leaned closer to James's ear.
But it won't matter. Lucan Adler is not going to come in close with a pistol. He will use a rifle, probably at extreme range.
James was shocked at the thought.
The last 2 presidents assassinated in this century,
was shot at close range with a pistol, he all but whispered.
Holmes nodded.
Lucan Adler will use a rifle, and we don't have to worry about the procession route, either here or once we're on the exposition grounds.
We don't? Said James. Why on earth not?
Lucan Adler doesn't care a fig for the anarchists' cause, said Holmes. He turns to them because they pay him well. He lives only to kill, preferably from long range. He's shot and killed 11 foreign leaders or dignitaries in the last 2 years.
Certainly that cannot be the case, cried James.
From his tweed jacket, Holmes pulled a small piece of paper showing a list of names and countries.
Good God, said James.
He and Sebastian Moran only barely missed assassinating Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth in 1888, said Holmes, and Lucan was still a boy at the time. He no longer works with Moran. All the assassinations on that list were his and his alone. James was speechless.
They approached the exposition from the northernmost western gate. Two members of the Colombian Guard, conspicuous in their uniforms of blue sackcloth, checked the special credentials that Holmes showed them, and two other guards swung the main gates wide. Ahead of them, the Midway Pleasance stretched ahead for more than a mile. James saw signs saying that they were now on the Avenue of Nations. When James had heard of the Midway Pleasance, he'd imagined a slightly larger version of the carnivals and fairs he'd known. But ahead of him, for 13 city blocks, were concessions and attractions the size of small towns. They passed a rugged log cabin, which James thought was a strange attraction.
That's the dreaded Sitting Bull's cabin, said Holmes. Unfortunately, Mr. Burnham, the director for the whole exposition, couldn't get Sitting Bull since the army killed him 3 years ago. So Chief Rain in the Face occupies it now, when he's not performing for Buffalo Bill's Wild West show just beyond the exposition grounds. Rain in the Face claims that he's the man who killed General Custer, and his fellow Sioux don't dispute it.
James looked at men wearing thick robes of hide and hair. They must have been insufferably hot even in this day's cool temperatures.
Lapland Village, said Holmes. God help them in July.
Some brown men wearing almost nothing at all except some leaves around their waists walked by.
Cannibals, said Holmes, from Dahomey.
Of what benefit to the Columbian Exposition are cannibals? Asked James.
It's a world exhibition, answered the detective. Daniel Burnham is trying to bring the world to 1 million Americans who could never afford to travel out to it.
What kind of man is Burnham? Asked James.
Handsome, commanding, busy, and driven, very, very driven.
I suppose one would have to be to build a complex like this in so short a time, but it looks far from finished.
On May 1st, it won't be quite finished, said Holmes, but except for Ferris's wheel that is going up, it will be all tidied up and it will look finished. Burnham is working the crews day and night, quite literally.
A man with an ostrich on a short rein crossed in front of their carriage.
California, said Holmes, which did not enlighten James.
Good heavens,
said James as they passed what looked to be an entire Austrian village, complete with stone buildings, towers, and inns.
A good place to get a stein of beer and some schnitzel once the fair opens, said Holmes.
James saw a large empty area boldly captioned Captive Balloon Park, but there was no balloon there yet.
What makes a balloon captive? He asked.
Ropes, said Holmes.
They'd come to the center of the Midway, and now James saw how large Mr. Ferris's wheel was going to be. Only half of the 264-foot-tall structure was completed, but the axle near the top of the finished half-frame looked as huge as a horizontal redwood tree made of steel. There was a protective wooden wall around the worksite, but suddenly one of the workmen on the upper tiers of steel beams and wooden frame shouted something and swung down from level to level like some arboreal creature. The workmen jumped down to a lower level,
used the top of the 7-foot safety fence as a jumping point, and landed right next to Holmes's halted landau. With a shock, James recognized Wiggins too, young Moth, dressed in the same workman's clothing as the other steelworkers and carpenters laboring on the Ferris wheel site. The boy had slept on a cot in Holmes's room their first night in Chicago, and James hadn't seen him or really thought about him since.
"Morning to you, gentlemen," said Wiggins.
"Greetings, Moth," said Holmes. "You appear to have found employment."
The boy grinned widely.
"I have at that, Mr. Holmes, and at full workman's wages. The supervisor, he says, Moth here, he's just a runt. But Mr. Ferris, who was here supervising the supervisor, as it were, says, I saw him climb, Baines. He's more monkey than runt, and stronger than most of your men. Give him a job on both the framing and steelwork. We need more monkeys, he says. And so he did. Oh, and I ain't called Moth no more. They call me Monk now, short for monkey."
"Do you mind that name?" asked James, leaning forward on his umbrella to see and speak beyond Holmes to his left. The boy grinned again.
"I love it, Mr. James. You see, the tough blokes on London streets, they called me Moth the old English way. What rhymes with moat, don't you see? And I was always being a moat in some fella's eye, and I didn't like that feeling. Although I admit that I did like the way my moat spoke. Although maybe Monk shall speak the same."
"How did you speak when you were moat?" asked James. Again the gap-toothed grin.
"So me supervisor, Mr. Riggins, asks the lot of us at lunch, how do I woo this Italian lady what lives in the tenement with me and never seems to notice me none? And nobody speaks a word, 'cause Mr. Riggins has an horrible temper, he does. But I says to him, I says, my complete master, Mr. Riggins, sir, you must jig off a tune at the tongue's end, canary to it with your feet, humour it with turning up your eyelids like, sigh a note and then sing a note, something through the throat, you see, as if you swallowed love with singing love, as it were. Then sometime through the nose, as if you snuffed up love by smelling love, all the time with your hat penthouse-like all tilted o'er the shop of your eyes, and with your arms crossed on your thin-belly paisley waistcoat like a rabbit on a spit, or maybe your hands in your pockets, such as that French geezer in the old painting. And this is important, sir, keep not too long in one tune, but a snip and away. These are compliments, you see. These are humours, as it were. These betray nice wenches nicely. Mostly them what will be betrayed without these tricks, I fully admit. But doing as I say makes you a man of note. Do you note, sir? Men that are most affected by these do these. And that concludes my penny of observation, I says to him."
Holmes threw back his head and laughed that sharp, barking laugh of his. James could only stare.
"You'll go far, Moth. I mean, Monk," said Holmes, and handed the boy a $10 bill.
"Thank ye, sir," said the boy, putting the bill in his cap, "and I hope it doesn't inconvenience you none that I ain't going back to England, but will seek to find me fortune here by becoming an American."
"Not at all," laughed Holmes. "You were a pleasure to work with when you were Wiggins II of Baker Street, but now is the time for you to show your true worth to the world."
"Mr. Ferris says this might not be the last wheel he builds," said the boy. "Although the others most likely would be smaller like. If I do well on the ice steel here, I might travel with his workers to other states, even other countries."
"May it be so, Monk," said Holmes, and told the coachman to drive on.
He turned back to shout at the boy,
"If you ever need anything, anything at all, Wiggins, you know where to find me."
The boy grinned and nodded.
"I do," he said. "I will. And God bless you, Mr. Sherlock Holmes."
When they'd traveled further, past what Holmes described as the Algerian village where robed ladies watched them through their veils as they passed by, then an empty street that Holmes said would be bustling Cairo in a week, complete with real Egyptians, James said,
"The lines from Love's Labor's Lost. Where on earth did Wiggins pick those up?"
I take my favorite and most promising lads to the theater, said Holmes.
I'd say that if they were born into better circumstances, many would have grown up to be MPs, but in truth, most are too smart and too honest for Parliament.
James thought about that as they passed a gigantic zoo, complete with gigantic zoo smells. The author heard a lion roar, and perhaps a hippopotamus making hippopotamus noises. He did not look up. Far to the west, there came a roar of a happy crowd from Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, which had been open for weeks and getting huge crowds. Their carriage turned right into a dazzling array of gigantic buildings, interspersed with canals, lagoons, bridges, and ponds. The largest lake was to their left. James could see the well-planned wooded island in its center, and the row of great buildings lined up to their right reminded James of the cliffs of Dover.
We're officially in the White City now, said Holmes. That's the woman's building we're just passing.
James could say nothing. He was surprised to find that he was physically stunned by the beauty, size, and layout of the White City, this mere fairgrounds as he'd thought of it in Washington. It felt to him like stepping into a clean, white, safe, sane future.
It's a little less than a mile to the administration building outside of which your President Cleveland will be speaking,
Holmes said softly so the driver could not hear.
Everything from this point forward is a potential assassin's roost.
Leaning on his umbrella, James turned to look at the man next to him. Holmes's eyes were bright with excitement.
And I need your help, James, to find where Lucan Adler plans to do his deadly deed on the 1st of May.
8. Friday, April 14, 10:42 a.m. The administration building where their voyage ended was essentially an 84-foot square supporting an oversized ribbed and octagonal dome. But it was beautifully made and held pride of place in the entire White City. Centered as it was halfway between the main western entrance where the trains would dislodge their passengers and the eastern peristyle entrance where those coming by boat would enter. There was an acre or more of paved open space around the administration building, but to the east was the Grand Basin that ran all the way to the peristyle. To the north were the large mines and electricity buildings with glimpses of the lagoon and wooded island down the narrow streets between them. To the southeast of it was a solid high wall of facades, the annex, the machinery hall, and the agriculture building, broached only by the southern canal with its graceful bridges and lighted walkways. Two men met them when Holmes and James alighted outside the east entrance to the administration building.
Mr. Henry James, said Holmes, may I have the honor of introducing you to Colonel Edmund Rice, commandant of the Columbian Guard and chief of security at the exposition.
James shook hands. Holmes had told him on the ride in that Edmund Rice had been awarded the Medal of Honor for the day at Gettysburg 30 years earlier, when he'd not only helped stop the Confederate General Pickett's charge, but was gravely wounded in the counterattack. Rice was a short, stocky man, balding, with a magnificent mustache. His natural expression seemed to be that of a scowl, but James soon understood that was somewhat misleading. Colonel Rice was an intensely serious man who could, on occasion, be wittily humorous. The other man, tall, thin, and immaculately tailored and turned out, was Mr. Andrew L. Drummond, head of the Secret Service.
Good heavens, said James. I had no idea that the United States had a spy agency also called the Secret Service, like the British.
Drummond smiled and explained that he was chief agent in the Treasury Department. Many of our men are well trained in security measures, said Drummond, including bodyguard protection, so we're helping out where we can with the president's visit to the exposition.
Shall we get started? Said Holmes.
Started with what? Asked James.
He felt that he was in the wrong place with the wrong people, doing the wrong things.
Looking over the grounds, to find where Lucan Adler is going to place himself on May 1st to kill the President of the United States, said Holmes.
You mean to guess where he might try such a thing? Said James.
Holmes gave him a frigid look.
You should know by now, James, he said flatly.
I never guess.
On the steps up to the higher of the administration building's two promenades, Drummond touched James's forearm slightly and stopped. James stopped as well.
I just wanted to tell you, Mr. James, in case I never get another chance, Drummond said softly, that I believe that you're the most brilliant writer alive, and that The Portrait of a Lady is the masterpiece of the 19th century.
James distantly heard his own voice muttering, "Most kind, very kind of you." And then they were climbing stairs again to the upper promenade. When they came out into the open air, James's morning surliness had disappeared. The torches and angels that James had seen through Holmes's telescope were all too large and solid close up. The line of fluted pillars holding the gas jets which illuminated the dome at night must have been 15 feet tall along the railing. In the angel tableaus, some of the angels' wings rose higher than that. When Drummond made some polite comment about the statuary, Colonel Edmund Rice removed the short, never-lit cigar from his mouth and said,
"Those damned angels! Getting them up here was harder than reducing Vicksburg. The straps broke on one of them, and the thing fell 30 feet, burying one wing 4 feet into the frozen ground while the rest of it flew all to pieces."
The four men gathered along the east railing of the upper promenade.
"Down there," said Colonel Rice,
pointing and moving his finger in a square to show size,
"will be the platform from which the president will speak. We won't let more than 50 people on that platform, and, Drummond, Mr. Burnham has given permission for two of your agents to stand near and behind the president during the speech."
"Any shot wouldn't come from behind," Drummond said softly.
"For security reasons, we're closing off the two promenades here on the administration building, and if you agree, Mr. Holmes, the wire to me and Mr. Burnham said that your advice was to be listened to and followed whenever possible. God knows why, but if you agree, we'll close off the promenades on all the high structures in line of sight and rifle range of where the president will be speaking." "Which structures will that include, Colonel?" asked Holmes.
The commandant of the Colombian Guards, out of uniform in shirt and suspenders as the clouds parted and the April day grew warmer, used the blunt cigar to point to their extreme right.
"The eastern parts of the big machinery building there."
The cigar shifted left, further east.
"The agriculture building next to it."
Rice pointed straight ahead with his cigar.
"The entrance peristyle has its own promenade, which will shut down during the ceremony."
The cigar moved left again.
"The huge monstrosity of the manufacturers and liberal arts building. Long, long promenade, almost as long as the great basin that runs down the middle here."
He pointed left to one of the great buildings they could see only part of.
"The eastern parts of the big electricity building there has a straight line to the speaker's stand. Most of the building doesn't."
"And then there are the avenues themselves," said Drummond.
"Yep," said Colonel Rice. "Look out there now and enjoy the sight of the 100 or so workers you see, because on opening day there'll be at least 100,000 people crammed into these open spaces."
"No place for a sniper in a crowd," said Drummond. "Our last two presidential assassinations have been with a handgun and at very short range."
"That's very true," said Holmes. "Lincoln, with a small pistol, shot from a distance of less than 3 feet, and President Garfield shot in the back, point-blank range by Guiteau."
"Who used a British-made bulldog revolver," said James Drummond.
"Very true," said Holmes. "An excellent weapon. My particular friend, Dr. John Watson, owns a bulldog revolver." "Assuming your theoretical assassin on May 1st, began Colonel Rice. "There's nothing theoretical about Lucan Adler, Colonel," Holmes said briskly. "All right. We'll assume that your would-be assassin will want to be somewhere high enough and stable enough and lonely enough that he can use a rifle. That could be from a window or from one of the promenades. Why don't we look at the four great buildings and peristyle going counterclockwise, starting with the machinery building there to the right?"
"Excellent idea, Colonel," said Holmes.
The roof of the machinery hall was all cupolas, arches, and Spanish Renaissance ornamented gewgaws to James's way of seeing things. In his opinion, neither asked for or stated, any self-respecting sniper would die from the bad taste of all that ornamentation before being able to fire a shot. But Colonel Rice, Drummond, and Holmes focused on the high second-story loggia, an inset veranda that ran the entire eastern length of the building, from the parade ground to the east of the administration building, where the president and his party would be all too visible, back west to the larger open ground in front of the terminal station.
You could get 1,000 people on this veranda, said Drummond, as if speaking to himself.
More than that, said Colonel Rice. Pack 'em 10 or 15 deep between these Corinthian columns, and this grand loggia'll hold 5,000 people easy.
Perhaps a bit crowded and joggly for rifle work, said Holmes.
Joggly? Said James. Holmes flashed one of those thin, fast, tight-lipped smiles. Moving toward Lake Michigan, Colonel Rice led them to the agriculture building, a domed, Roman-style structure encompassing 500,000 square feet of display space. Before they got too close, Colonel Rice pointed out Augustus St. Gaudens's gold statue of Diana, poised on one leg with her bow at full pull, that graced the top of the dome.
It was supposed to go on top of the new Madison Square Garden building, grunted Rice, but it was too damned big. It serves as a good weather vane here.
Before they entered the building, James gawked at the presence of dozens, perhaps scores, of whirling, full-sized windmills of all shapes and sizes and materials, wood, iron, steel, that filled an area near the lagoon outside the agriculture building.
That army would prove too much even for Don Quixote, said James.
The other three men looked at him and said nothing.
If you're hungry, gentlemen, said Colonel Rice
as they climbed steps to the upper regions,
Canada sent a 22,000-pound hunk of cheese to be exhibited down there. It's encased in iron and, the Canadians say, took 1,600 milkmaids to milk 10,000 cows to produce the 27,000 gallons of milk used to make the cheese.
A fascinating bit of information, said Holmes,
who, unlike James, was not in the least winded by the endless flights of steps.
And now that I've learned it, I will eliminate it from my memory.
James thought it just a figure of speech, but Colonel Rice stopped and faced Holmes.
You can do that, sir? Remove things from your memory?
I have to do it, Holmes said in a serious tone.
Why? Said the colonel.
I was born with what some experts are now calling a photographic memory, said Holmes. It is my misfortune to remember everything. Give me a page of a magazine, and after glancing over it, I can recall every word, comma, and full stop on the page. But the mind is a little attic, as I once tried to explain to my associate, Dr. Watson, and someone with a profession as defined as mine must be careful what to store there. If I know for certain that the information cannot help me in my detection, say the fact that the sun does not go around the earth, or the details of this great mass of Canadian cheese, I simply delete it from memory.